from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. According to Michael Roth, it doesn't matter what you study in college, but how you study it. In his new book, the Wesleyan University president defends the traditional liberal education, which is falling out of favor as students increasingly pursue coursework they think will make them more attractive to employers. Roth joins us to talk about his new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, and to discuss student debt and the rise of online courses. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Historian Michael Roth joins us in studio for this Forum hour, the author of five books. He served as president of the California College of the Arts in San Francisco from 2000 to 2007. And at end 2007, he took over as president of Wesleyan University in Connecticut. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, and he recently published Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. Joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and good to have you back.
Well, it's great to be back, Michael.
Yeah, I think you miss us here in the Bay Area, don't you?
I do. Just here for 24 hours and hearing about the great things that CCA is doing and seeing some old friends, it's a tease, but it's great to be back.
Well, it's good to have you back on Forum, and especially with it, we just did a whole hour, as you know, on this ruling that came down in Southern California yesterday about tenure. Get a quick take from you on tenure.
Well, you know, I was fascinated to listen to the discussion. We have tenure, of course, at Wesleyan University, and as most universities do that are highly selective and that are small. At the big publics, we still have tenure, but that's been eroded by the hiring of adjunct faculty who teach mostly on a part-time basis and mostly without benefits. And if that's any indication of the demise of tenure, it's a horrible prospect. You don't increase quality of teaching. You don't up performance, all of these things that are promised as tenure is attacked. What you do is you make it easier to exploit the teachers. And usually exploiting people does not get better performance. That said, at a place like Wesleyan, it takes 7 years to become eligible for tenure, and the criteria for promotion are extraordinarily difficult. And that is a process that ensures that when you get tenured, when you become wedded to the institution, you have already demonstrated a great ability as a teacher and a scholar. And I do think that there are places like Wesleyan, and CCA has a tenure for some of its faculty as well, where teaching is just as important as scholarship and artistic practice for getting that tenured appointment. And I think if the standards are high enough and if that period of probation or of evaluation is long enough, it's a great system. But when you truncate the period of evaluation, then you really have a shotgun wedding, and the opportunities for being stuck with someone whose performance is not going to be consistent over a long period of time is a great danger.
Well, that was a big part of this decision, that it's only 2 years, and this did not apply to colleges or universities.
Right.
But you're here to talk about liberal education, though. This is a morning talking about liberal education, and my hat goes off for the fact that you've taken on a subject which has confounded people and perplexed people and baffled them for years now. But most people associate liberal education with inquiry and critical thinking and making meaning, the Spencerian man, the Renaissance man, good citizenship, that all of that. But now we have that set against, in many people's minds, the idea of a college education for the marketplace. You know, better to learn coding than to learn about the arts or philosophy or history, because if you learn something technical like that, you're more apt to get a job.
Well, sure. That is a great part of the argument today around college and university education. And it's particularly strong in this part of the world, and there are Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who, as you know, are paying people to drop out of college. They're
Peter Thiel, by name.
Yes, they're usually paying people less than the scholarships they were receiving at universities, and sometimes getting in exchange a piece of whatever companies they create. But in American history, the debate about how practical a college education should be goes back right to the founding of the country. And I think the problem today is we have this polarized discourse around education where people think that somehow a utilitarian, marketplace-oriented education has to take place at the expense of a broad and contextual one. I think that's just a big mistake. It was a mistake when Thomas Jefferson was arguing for basic scientific research. It was a mistake when Franklin was arguing for establishment of the University of Pennsylvania. And in the book, I talk about Du Bois and Jane Addams and these figures throughout American history who insisted that a broad contextual education would serve you well after you graduated. They weren't saying you should have a broad contextual education so that you could, you know, hobnob with the rich and famous or drop names at cocktail parties or even learn a specific technical language like coding. They were saying you should have a broad contextual education because that will serve you well as someone who works in the marketplace, but also someone who is a citizen, someone who is a neighbor, and someone who's going to continue to learn well beyond the university years.
Well, liberal education even has ancient roots, as you point out in your book. But let's bring in some of these historical figures because you just managed to bring them in. I mean, Jefferson said education is a key preparation not only for citizenship, but as an important weapon in fighting abuses of wealth and power.
Yes. For Jefferson, education was one of the great ways we protect ourselves against the government and against the wealthy, because he thought that education properly administered would be open to people so that the talented would acquire the tools to succeed in the world and the decadent rich would fall by the wayside. So for Jefferson, an unnatural aristocracy was an aristocracy of wealth and privilege. A natural aristocracy was what he called the ways in which people can acquire the capacity to be successful in the world, and they acquire that capacity through an education. And Jefferson, much like the debate you had here this morning, Jefferson argued that that should be at the public expense, that we have to fund adequately our primary, secondary, and tertiary educational systems so that, he used to say, rake the rubbish, find people you would least expect to succeed in school, people who seem downtrodden, and find in that group people who would thrive because they get the tools from education that would allow them to compete successfully in the marketplace, in scientific research, in the arts, and because otherwise wealthy people will protect their wealth and make it harder and harder for anyone else to enter the higher echelons of the society.
So this is essentially the argument that you form. I mean, you use the historical roots here and you go back to some of these major patriarchal figures.
Yes.
And liberal education is essential, though, for a democratic society. I mean, that's really what your argument is based on, is the idea that in order to really be an informed citizen, a good citizen, to be championing democracy in its best sense, liberal education is the best way, the best vehicle.
It's absolutely essential. And I should say that I don't use the phrase very often liberal arts education, because liberal arts education often connotes a specific set of disciplines, that you should learn Greek or Latin, that you should learn a certain amount of X, a certain amount of Y, a certain amount of Z while you're in college. A liberal education, as opposed to liberal arts education, is really about learning to learn. Any discipline, John Dewey argued, any discipline can be taught in a liberal way, by which he meant a way that encourages a broad, open-ended inquiry. And so it's not so much that we shouldn't teach engineering or that we shouldn't teach coding. On the contrary, we should teach both of those things in schools that are committed to liberal education. But we should teach them in such a way that as citizens and as thinkers, we can understand them in their social political context. And I'm glad you mentioned the patriarchal dimension, because, as you know, in the book, I also have this section on Jane Addams, who injected a very different ingredient to the conversations about education in early part of the 20th century.
Well, she was talking about education for empathy and cooperation largely, actually.
Exactly. And so as a pragmatist, we were very much emphasizing broad contextual education, but one that had to prove itself in the world, right? Not just in the drawing room or in high society. Jane Addams said, hey, wait a minute, boys, that sometimes what education does is make you less capable of feeling, make you less capable of acting on someone else's behalf. And she tells this great story how when she sees an accident take place, and instead of responding immediately to this tragedy in front of her, she thinks of an example in the literature that evokes an accident and someone's failure to respond. And she realized that her education had, she said, lumbered her mind. She had all the stuff in her head that kept her from acting in a human, empathic way. And so she argued for an educational approach that teased out empathy, that underscored cooperation. And that contribution to the conversation around education was embraced by William James and then by John Dewey. And I think it's really an important part of contemporary education.
And if you just joined us, we're talking with Michael Roth, who is president of Wesleyan University, author of Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. And you're talking about a pretty pragmatic liberal education, aren't you?
Absolutely. That's the phrase I use in the end, is that a pragmatic liberal education is one that is quintessentially American. It's different from the ancient traditions of liberal arts education, and because they did assume that education was connected to freedom, as did the American thinkers, but they also thought that freedom was connected to leisure. And what the American pragmatists did from the late 19th century throughout the 20th century is they connected freedom to action that made a difference in the world. So for James, for Jane Addams, for John Dewey, for Rorty, who was my teacher when I was a graduate student, for Martha Nussbaum, these are people who think that education should prove itself in the world. It isn't just about acquiring veneer. It's about acquiring capacity to do stuff after you leave the university.
And this is very American. I mean, pragmatism is probably the only indigenous American philosophy.
So many people say that, and I think with a strong argument. And you know, European philosophers often look down at pragmatism because it – and, you know, James talked about the cash value of an idea, and Richard Rorty talked extensively about the importance of making sure that we kept our work in a social and political context that was right around us, and not just for academics. But the American pragmatists wedded a commitment to logical inquiry and an approach to science that made sense of it in context with a strong desire to see that thinking had an impact on the way we live, on the problems that matter to us, not just at the university, but beyond the university.
I had the privilege, actually, of interviewing Richard Rorty a number of years ago. This gets down to a lot of this can be defined as a tradition of how I learn how to be a whole person.
Yes.
I think that's at the core of what your argument is all about. But you get into a lot of class stuff here, too. You talk about, you know, being aware of one's – it gets back to Jefferson, too – advantages and privilege and so forth, which a lot of students up there at Wesleyan who come from those patrician backgrounds and so forth. But then you even talk about wealthy people sort of protecting their advantages by limiting access to higher education.
Yeah, well, you can imagine that people act in their own interests whenever they can. It's Jefferson worried that government officials and wealthy people would try to protect their privileges and that education was a way of making those who didn't have those privileges, making them more aware of them and making those that were illegitimate open for contestation.
Well, that didn't include in Jefferson's day women or slaves or
– Exactly. And then one of the parts of this I found so fascinating in doing the research for the book was that Jefferson had so many areas of hypocrisy and prejudice and especially around race and to a strong extent around gender. But his ideas are taken up by black writers in the middle of the 19th century. They're taken up by people after black writers after emancipation. They extend the Jeffersonian ideal to a broader aspect of society. And the same thing for Jane Addams. She speaks often in a Jeffersonian voice, but without that Jeffersonian prejudice.
Well, is it different, for example, for minorities and the poor? And I'm thinking specifically about the kind of dichotomy we were talking about before, which reaches back to W.E.B. Du Bois and
yeah.
Booker T. Washington. I mean, Booker T. Washington was of the mind that, you know, people of African-American descent to move up the ladder socially, economically, had to learn trade, had to learn how to do jobs. And for Du Bois, it was essentially what you're arguing, you know, liberal education, the talented 10th could lift up the other masses of people.
Absolutely. And I encountered this debate between Booker T. Washington and Du Bois through the work of the philosopher Anthony Appiah, who's a great contemporary philosopher in the United States. He showed that that debate between Washington's emphasis on narrow utilitarianism and Du Bois' emphasis on a broad contextual learning very much speaks to us today. And you can clearly understand why Du Bois is saying what you really need is a trade. We really need people to be carpenters. We really need people to be farmers. We need physicians. And at the same time, what Du Bois acknowledges that, but he says we just don't know that you, John, should be the carpenter. You might be the carpenter, but you may actually be the novelist. You may actually be the musician. You may actually be the accountant or something else. And so what Du Bois argued is, yes, we need these trades. We need to have practical skills, but we don't need to track people into professions or activities that limit their horizons in advance of seeing what they can do and what they can learn.
Do farmers need to learn Shakespeare?
Do they need to learn Shakespeare? No. But is it a great blessing to a society when you have farmers who are educated and can understand the context of their work and have the ability to think broadly and appreciate a wide range of cultural activities, as many farmers do? that's a great thing, and that's been an American ideal, right? The farmer who maybe not quoting Shakespeare necessarily, but the farmer who has a curiosity that keeps the person learning throughout his or her life.
Talking with Michael Roth, who is president of Wesleyan University, author of Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, and he says in there that we have a creeping culture of pessimism about the quality of undergraduate learning. That's certainly true. Some of you may want to weigh in, and we'll open our phone line shortly, but I'm interested in talking to you about MOOCs, because you write a lot about MOOCs, and you've had experience. You taught about 30,000 students enrolled in your modernism, postmodernism,
yes,
MOOCs class, and you talk about it as a colloquy mediated by technology, which is a good way to describe it, but you're sort of a believer, I mean, because we've done a lot of debating on
it.
What do you see as the value of that, particularly, I guess, and we're moving toward disseminating and trying to advance a liberal education ethos?
Well, I think that the MOOCs can be an interesting tool.
Oh, excuse me. I'm talking about massive open online classes.
Yes, right. So the first time I offered this basic humanities class that I've taught for over 20 years, it's really, I call it a good enough books course, where we start with Rousseau and Kant and work our way up to Virginia Woolf and contemporary writers. And I did not expect that to translate well to the online environment. And I was very surprised. The first iteration had 30,000 students. And, of course, not a strong percentage have finished the course. But most of them didn't intend to finish the course. What they did intend to do was to listen to lectures, hundreds of thousands of lectures, and write papers and talk to one another online about kind of classic issues in the humanities. And so along with about five or six of my colleagues at Wesleyan, have offered these large classes, not because we think they're a substitute for face-to-face instruction, but because we think they're an interesting tool to use to augment what we do in the classroom and to find also around the world, because most of the students I've had are outside of the U.S., find out around the world what people want to learn and how we might respond to that effectively. And I've written about this saying I'm the least likely guy to do a MOOC because I'm technologically challenged. I was very skeptical about it. But I found it one of the most exciting pedagogical experiences I've had in all these years of teaching, because I got to know many of the students via the discussion boards or via email. And I was very surprised at the depth of their engagement with the material, much like the students I have at Wesleyan or I had here at CCA, that they find the reading of these great texts transformative, and they find lectures, even delivered online, to be extraordinarily helpful in opening up these issues for their consideration.
And the kind of issues we're talking about here, I mean, don't they often have to do with moral thinking, value thinking, or
absolutely,
oriented toward moral and values?
Yeah, making meaning out of the world around you. So in that course, we start off with Rousseau and the question of whether education is a form of corruption rather than leading to progress. We read Baudelaire, who really upset many of my students in the MOOC because of his amoralism or sometimes anti-moral views. And many of the students actually many American students were very upset by Baudelaire and Nietzsche in ways I hadn't encountered on a campus, where they kind of, it's not cool to be too righteous about things. But these are older students. They're often professionals, and they they don't hold back online when they're they have the privilege of anonymity. And I thought their engagement with these moral, political, and philosophical issues was really striking. I thought MOOCs were going to be mostly for computer scientists and for technical training and for folks doing artificial intelligence work. But we've offered classes in Greek history, in film studies, in statistics and calculus and so on. But all of the classes have found audiences that are very receptive and interested in continuing to learn. And for me, that's the most important takeaway, is that liberal education still speaks to millions of people around the globe if we know how to speak it well.
There's a statistic that I came across. Association of American Colleges and Universities says that 80% of employers actually prefer a liberal arts and sciences foundation, regardless of major. In other words, broad-based education. I mean, that's an extraordinary statistic when you think about it. But here's the parents worried about, you know, how's it going to translate in the marketplace? Students worried about student debt. And this is, again, a pragmatic view. I have to do something that's going to prepare me for the marketplace to get a job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it's our responsibility as leaders of liberal arts universities and colleges to make sure that our students are equipped to compete in the marketplace when they leave our campuses. However, you don't want to prepare for the worst job you'll ever have. I mean, that shouldn't be your only preparation, because the first job you get out of college should be the worst job, not the best job. And so you want to be prepared for a lifetime of work that makes a difference in the world. And so that may mean that you don't spend all your time on technical things that will be irrelevant 5 years from now. You don't want to be trained at something that's going to now be obsolete in 2 years. You want to have a broad contextual education that will allow you to shape change and not just to be disempowered by it.
But you also don't want to spend, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars and get in debt and not necessarily have any opening or possibility of employment.
Absolutely. And I do think the crisis of student debt in this country is a shameful thing. And we've at Wesleyan, which is an expensive school, although we do have financial aid for almost half of our students and we meet full need, still the propensity of many schools to have high loans and saddle students with debt after they graduate is a real tragedy for many people. And there's this new documentary film coming out, Ivory Tower, by Andrew Rossi, and he underscores the problem with the university system that thrives on the student loan system saddles graduates with debt, which hampers their ability to make choices after graduation. You know, education should increase your range of choices when you leave the school. That has been a fundamental tenet of American thinking about education since the founding of the country. But when you leave school with all this debt, you have very few choices. You really have to find a way to make those payments.
Well, we'll continue this conversation about the value of a liberal education with Michael Roth. Excuse me. We'll also take your questions and comments after a short break. Do you think a well-rounded college education still has value, or is it a luxury in today's competitive job market? You may want to join us in conversation. If you'd like to do so, call us, 866-733-6786. That's toll-free from wherever you're listening. Or however, 866-733-6786. You can also email questions or comments to forum at kqed.org or post them onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about a liberal education, what it means to be well-educated, and about the role of higher education in society. You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and Michael Roth is our guest. He's president of Wesleyan University and author of a new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, and have to go to this online comment right away. Mr. Roth, what can you say to the rising cost of liberal arts education education, more specifically on the long-term effects on students who take out loans to be able to attend universities like Wesleyan. You shook my hand in 2008, the culmination of my wonderful education at Wesleyan, studying with Alvin Lucier, Anthony Braxton, Ron Caviglia, Leo Lensing, I hope I'm getting these names pronounced right, and Scott Higgins, to name a specific few. My time at Wesleyan was incredible, though. With over six figures in debt, I hesitate to ever say invaluable. Be interested in hearing your thoughts on this.
Well, he had a great experience of some of the most avant-garde musical performers and composers in America, at least. But he also clearly has taken on a lot more debt than he's comfortable with. And some of that debt, I have to say, in 2008, that was my first year at Wesleyan, and some of that debt was probably part of his financial aid package. At that level, some of it he decided to borrow for other reasons. I do think it's a terrible thing. And my first year, we cut student loan requirements by 35%, and then we eliminated loans for the neediest students. And this year, we've extended that, what the neediest means, so that there are no loans for more students. And so I think that's absolutely vital. And places like Wesleyan can have some loans that are required for students who can afford them. And what I mean by that are loans of about $4,000 a year or so. But I think that the rates of indebtedness of students in this country is really shocking. And there's a whole sector of higher education in the for-profit sector where all of the tuition comes from student loans and nobody really graduates and the default rates are horrific. And I do think that is a tremendous problem. And I am sorry that my alumnus there graduated at a time when loans were too high. We have brought them down and we're going to keep bringing them down.
I keep getting things from all sides of the political spectrum, as you might imagine, both from listeners and, well, because of the job I have. Somebody sent me an audio clip of Glenn Beck, who's, you know, there on the right, mm-hmm. you know, wouldn't necessarily be someone that I would be disposed to quoting, but he does say things sometimes that are provocative and sometimes even intelligent or illuminating. And what he was saying was, if you can't afford a college loan, you shouldn't go to college. You shouldn't go into debt. I mean, this is a rather strident thing to say. He said, I couldn't afford college, so I didn't go to college because I didn't want to be in debt.
Well, we have in this country a long history, and in this state of California, a long history of saying that if you want to go to college, you should be able to find a college that's affordable. And that is part of the public responsibility that we bear for having an educated citizenry. Otherwise, the country will be even more controlled by the wealthy, who will look after their own affairs, but not over the common good. And so I do think the public responsibility for providing access to affordable education is absolutely crucial. And that's on one side. On the other side, the pursuit of a luxurious education by many colleges and universities in this country is shameful. They're catering to the wealthy and they are inciting people to borrow money so they can have that full spa experience at a university. I think it's counter-educational. So that doesn't excuse the states from supporting community colleges, from providing public universities with high levels of support, and tying that support to effective teaching, good graduation rates. I think that we've gotten to a place now where the polarized debate around education is much like the rest of the debate in Washington, is that we are ignoring some of the fundamental issues. And the fundamental issue is that there should be in this country a public support for high-quality college education. Everyone who wants to get a two-year degree should be able to afford a two-year degree without excessive debt. Many of the students who get that two-year degree will go on to get a four-year degree. And this makes economic sense, Michael. It's not just a kind of liberal ideological position. We know that from students from the bottom quintile of the economic ladder are most likely going to wind up in the bottom quintile of the economic ladder. But if they go to school, if they get a degree, not just go, but if they get a degree, even a two-year degree or a four-year degree.
Economic prospects are much brighter.
Much brighter. 80% of them won't be there.
What about forgiving student debt? I mean, the president has hinted that this is something he'd like to do.
Well, I think that it's very easy to gain applause for giving debt. The question is, like, what happens next then? Who's going to lend money next year if the prospects of getting repaid are not there? So I think that the president's proposal to tie debt to debt repayment to income makes a lot of sense. I think Senator Warren's proposal to pay for increased support of fair repayment through closing tax loopholes on the wealthiest makes a lot of sense. It was just it won't come to a vote, as you know, because it was filibustered. I do think there are things we can do to rationalize the repayment program for many of our students. But we also have to get out of the system the bad actors who are basically soaking up student loan income without having effective graduation rates or without taking care of their students.
Let's go to your calls. We begin, Dan, with you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I am very, very excited about reading this book. A lot of the new economic book by Piketty is getting a lot of news, but in my opinion, this book is probably as important, if not more important. My experience is that I went to a liberal arts college. I now live in Santa Clara, which is in Silicon Valley. And there are a lot of men my age who got the technical degree and are stuck. So I could not agree more that if you just go all technical and not liberal education, you have some real problems, certainly in one of the hearts of technical innovation. What I did notice and what I did want to get your guest's opinion on is at Oberlin College, I had a biology degree, and I was able to take full advantage of what the your guest is calling the liberal education. Many of the students there didn't. When I got my graduate degree, I experienced a hostility towards science amongst people in the humanities. And I was wondering if the author has noticed that, and if so, what's going on, and why is it that some elements of our academy have turned against rational discourse along a scientific or empirical bent? Thank you. I'll take my comment offline.
Okay. Thank you for the call.
Thank you so much for that. Good question. The anti-science attitude in the much of the humanities was all the rage. I think probably in the 80s and maybe into the 90s.
It's tamped down. Yeah,
quite a bit. It's changed quite a bit. At Wesleyan and many other places, where we now have really interesting partnerships between scientists and economists, between scientists and artists. We have at Wesleyan now a College of the Environment, where everyone in that program has a double major. So they have environmental science and biology, as you'd expect, environmental science and economics, you might expect. But they also have environmental science and anthropology, environmental science and dance. And these people all work together on producing work that will be published by outsiders. So in other words, they go into the marketplace with their research. And the reason they do this is because they feel that these environmental issues, issues of global climate change, are not going to be confined to any specific discipline. And they're not going to be confined to a sector of disciplines. We need the cooperation of people who are engaged in inquiry. And inquiry takes place in the arts, inquiry takes place in the sciences, and we have to give our students the ability to move among these disciplines, to translate from one form of knowledge to another.
I was involved for many years in a program that tried to bring the two cultures, as
yes.
Snow Leavis called them, together. Excuse me. Interdisciplinary work is also really and should be a part of what we're talking about as a good liberal education, a central part of it. No?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that has happened in the United States, and it really began in the 19th century, is that you have the pursuit of specialization dovetails with the pursuit of prestige. So people get narrower and narrower in the academy because that's the ticket to professional advancement. And then the research university modeled on the German research university really underscored specialization. But if you only have specialists, then nobody can talk to each other. They're all locked in their silos. And I think the great thing about institutions like Oberlin, for example, that preserve this commitment to liberal learning is that they preserve a commitment to translation among the disciplines. It's not a choice between science and the humanities. It is a commitment to inquiry.
Here's another caller. Jack, that's you. Good morning.
Michael, thank you. Well, I do agree with the panelists regarding the value of a liberal arts education. I have an education from a school here in San Francisco. I studied literature and film, and my road's been very tough. As we all know, San Francisco Bay Area is a very expensive place to live, and I haven't been able to really eke out a very good living. And I've noticed a lot of my group that studied engineering and pharmacies and nurses, they're doing quite well right now. And the earlier caller talked about the people that studied tech and got stuck. I agree that, yeah, maybe some of them are not happy doing what they're doing, but, you know, many of them probably got stuck in a job that at least pays their way. So, you know, on the one hand, I value my education. I learned a lot about William Blake and romantics and about the male gaze and cinema and all that. But trying to make a living doing it has been tough. Thanks.
Thank you. He's right.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Learning how to translate those that kind of on-campus discourse into what you're going to do after graduation is absolutely crucial. And I think it's the responsibility of the institutions to help in that process.
Well, I hear a couple of listeners who write on Facebook. Katie writes, I have a BA in English Literature and an MLIS or Master's in Library Science. I haven't found it too difficult. I usually stress my critical thinking and communication skills in interviews. I currently work managing pharmaceutical documents and records. At the very least, I think everyone needs to take some critical analytical thinking and communication courses in their college careers. And Noah writes on Facebook, no reason you can't get a marketable degree and take liberal arts classes as electives. Tony writes on Facebook, a liberal arts education opens the world to the student. Whether that education is designed for a career or not is as important as providing the means to think critically about the world around you. And another Facebook comment from Jenny, who writes, my experience in a liberal arts college provided me with not only an excellent academic education, but with opportunities to explore, discover, and play around with who I was and who I wanted to be. I got to know my professors, not just in the classroom, but at dinners they put on for their students, at campus events, and as the babysitter for their children. Yeah. Office hours were used in my experience as a teacher. Students rarely use my office hours, but as a liberal arts student, I was visiting professors often just to talk about ideas, theories, concepts, not to ask nitty-gritty questions about grades or points. It felt intellectual. It felt supported. It felt safe. I wish liberal arts education was the way that every higher education institution was organized and as a public good, not this neoliberalized pay-to-play system we have now. I'm the first in my family to attend college. I took on a lot of debt, but I would not trade it for anything in the world. Let me read a few Twitter comments here. This is a tweet from a listener who writes, thank you for making the point that coding isn't the panacea that Ro Khanna would have us believe. Creative thinking is more so. Ro Khanna is a guy who's running for Congress down in the South Bay. I don't know if he believes that, but that's the interpretation of that listener. And here's Barry who writes, your guest mentioned it, and I hear it mentioned often as it's if it's significant to the labor market, that software companies hiring young people away from college and giving them equity in a startup. Does your guest or anyone anywhere have evidence of how many workers are described by this scenario? It's talked about as if it's a significant part of the workforce and economy. Is it really? Is this a real path for millions of future young workers all writing code? I don't think so.
No.
As automation systems improve, coding jobs will be culled, obviously. This is already happening. And Bill writes, fine to talk about the values of a good liberal arts education, and those values are many. However, in a world in which it costs more to get a four-year degree at places like Wesleyan than it does to buy a house and a car, one can hardly blame students who have to pay attention to how they're going to pay off their loans. More college presidents are making $1 million a year than ever before, and the ranks of college administrations get more bloated by the year. And why don't they take a pay cut and help reduce the cost of college so that students have the luxury of pursuing the many benefits that a liberal education offers?
That's a great point. And I hear it often. You know, Wesleyan is a contentious place. And when I was hired for the job, the trustees said something to me about how beautiful the office is. And I said, yes, I know. I slept in it as a student when we occupied the office. And Wesleyan is still a place of, you know, great political ferment. And that point about bloated administrations is, I think, really important. And we've tried very hard to cut and we have cut administrative expenses pretty dramatically. That said, the tasks of a residential college or university today are many, and the making sure that students have the support they need so that they can graduate on time is absolutely key. I think it is part of our responsibility when you have an undergraduate-focused education to help those students, whatever they're studying, see how they're going to translate what they're doing on campus to what happens beyond the university. I had just a brief correspondence with the head human resources person at Google because I sent him a copy of the book when I read Tom Friedman's column about what Google is looking for in students. You know, it was all this technical stuff. And I noticed, I looked him up online, and he was a graduate of Pomona College, a great liberal arts school down in Southern California. And he just wrote me back, actually, just as I was arriving in San Francisco, saying for him, a liberal education is absolutely crucial when he's hiring people at Google. They're looking for folks who are going to continue to learn, who are going to continue to adapt, who are not just going to have critical thinking, Michael. I think it's very important to emphasize they have the kind of thinking that will create opportunity. I've written a couple of op-eds about how critical thinking is overrated, because we also want creative thinking, thinking that will open up doors and take risks and not just thinking that will critique other things.
Innovative thinking, really. Yes. Yeah. Let's get another caller on here. Adrienne, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to offer some hope to students who are considering taking a liberal studies or humanities major or switching majors. I received my bachelor's degree in the early 90s from another very expensive school called Pepperdine down in Southern California. And back in that day, there was a lot of hesitation in encouraging people to pursue a liberal studies major because they thought, you know, what are you going to do with that? In fact, I had a counselor tell me I would never be able to own a home. I would probably have trouble getting credit cards, et cetera. But I'm here to feel validated because I've owned a couple of homes in Marin now, and you know, I wanted a liberal studies major because I wanted to have a variety of jobs in my career, and I've been able to do that and earn a living.
Could you tell us how you earn a living, Adrienne? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, I do a lot of different things. Right now, I'm driving to the airport to pick up an author. So I do author escorting. I work in a bookstore. I do marketing for a vintage movie theater. I play violin still.
And these are ways that enabled you literally to buy a home in Marin County?
Yeah, they have. And so I just wanted to encourage people that, you know, even though we've come a long, long way, there are ways that you can, as the author said, you know, really contribute to your society. It's not all about making money, but it's about doing your part to, you know, fulfill the cultural standards that have been set forth really in our Constitution, you know, pursuit of happiness.
Well, we thank you for that encouraging remarks, for those encouraging remarks, and we'll get another caller right on. Andrew, hi, you're on.
Hi, Andrew from San Francisco. I got a political science degree from Boston University. For a while, I used it in trying to follow my dreams of, you know, changing the world. I actually wrote some pretty awesome conservation legislation, then ended up doing some consulting services here and there for places like Google. But for the last 2 years, absolutely nothing. Been kind of consulting here and there, but mainly working retail. And one of the things that you notice in the retail sector in San Francisco is a lot of the people who work in these places have bachelor's degrees in the liberal arts. And while they're doing all this other stuff, trying to put together some sort of life, they're still trying to find that way out, that nugget out. And it still seems, you know, as great as the last caller was, that the bachelor seems still to be a stepping stone to the master's or some other further education that will actually get you that dream job that will help you do what you want to do but still be able to eat.
Andrew, I'm glad you called, and I thank you for those comments. And it goes right to the heart of things, Michael Roth. I mean, there are a lot of people, liberal arts, BA, baccalaureate degrees out there, not only selling in retail, but also waiting on tables and
absolutely
driving cabs and on and on.
Yeah, and, you know, having been president of an art school, this is not news to me. And even though at CCA there's also an architecture school and a design program, what we emphasized there was the liberal learning through the arts, so as to broaden your capacity to continue to do your work after graduation because you have other skills that you can use to support yourself. This is a tough job market. I mean, it's gotten a little bit better in the last few years, but it's still a very difficult economy for people looking for work where they can use their heads. It's hard, but you know it's also hard for people who major in business administration. They one of the most popular majors across the country has the lowest salary thresholds. It's not just the liberal education that gets in the way of finding a job where you can actually use your full cognitive capacity. It's an economy that's going through some really torturous shifts. I've said this before, and I think it's so important that schools like Wesleyan, schools like Boston College or Harvard or Yale, these are schools that should actually be driving that point home while the students are undergraduates. So they begin to think, how are they going to continue to learn after graduation while they are working? They have to start thinking about how it's going to be pragmatic liberal education. It's not just liberal education. My book's about the pragmatic part, too, because I do think it's very important to recognize these economic challenges. But the economic challenges are not going to be met by becoming more and more narrow. They're going to be met by becoming more and more innovative.
Again, our guest is Michael Roth, and his book is Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. And let's get Scott on. Scott, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hey, thanks so much, and good morning. I graduated Wesleyan in 1999. I switched majors four times. I ended up with physical anthropology and U.S. history and a huge amount of debt. We couldn't afford the tuition, so I worked my way through college. I still am paying off my student loan 15 years later, so I appreciate you fighting the good fight for us. We're kind of trapped. But I guess my point was that I got directly into the corporate world. I felt like I had a huge amount of debt I needed to pay off, and I wanted to do it as soon as I could. But I felt trapped and stifled. After a year, I left. I got into climbing trees, and 14 years later, here I am running a tree business in San Francisco. We do all sorts of maintenance and tree installations and removals, and I couldn't be happier except for the fact that every month I'm still paying off my student loans. So I also wanted to just speak to the value of a good education, because I've gotten jobs, got a specific job from an author who appreciated that I used a semicolon appropriately in one of my estimates.
This is one of the great values in life, to use the correct semicolon. any employer looking for job prospects, find out how they can use a semicolon. It can make a great deal of difference. Here's a postscript remark from Wanda, who says, "Do farmers need Shakespeare? My doctor once told me he would not like to go to a physician who had never studied Shakespeare. The humanities are not needed for most professional education, but they make better quality human beings. The democracy needs well-rounded humans. The absence of well-rounded human beings is one of the marks of despotic and abusive governments." Alex has two comments. "Used to be that a high school diploma indicated at least the firm foundation of a liberal education, enough to make someone capable to be an informed voter, a good neighbor, solid citizen. In many cases, in many places, that is no longer true. A liberal education should be part of lifelong learning, not just the years someone spends in formal full-time higher education. But this is impeded by our cultural fascination with entertainment versus education, and with the denial by a significant part of one of our political parties of the value of any education apart from reading the Bible." Some more opinions weighed in.
Yes.
Here. Another listener. "I have to say, though, that more basic science needs to be promoted, too. Perhaps mixing the two is communicating scientific principles is as important as learning them, and unfortunately, we still like to polarize our students when we really need to mix them up." Mike writes, "When I look at top 10 things employers are looking for, lists, 8 or 9 out of the 10 are usually goals of the traditional liberal arts education, things like writing ability, creativity, critical thinking and problem solving, ability to understand different perspectives, etc. Unless a student chooses a very specific vocation, such as nursing or civil engineering, soft skills taught in liberal arts programs seem just as relevant as they ever were." And Martin in San Francisco writes, "The premise and point of a college education is to educate you, help make you smart, not to get you a job. Liberal arts colleges are not trade schools." Elizabeth in Oakland writes, "The job market is tough no matter what kind of degree you hold.
Right.
I have a BA in art history and an MBA, and neither one helped me get a job. With a degree in art history, I was deemed unqualified for many jobs. With the MBA, I was deemed too expensive for many others. Not hiring someone because they have a liberal arts degree is just an excuse." And here's a tweet from a listener who says, "Whether at work, politics, or school, we would rather spend efforts preparing for the next test than getting better at something." One more comment from Mark in Berkeley, who says, "It seems clear to me that the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement would not have been successful without a sympathetic population trained in liberal education. As Mr. Ross says, perhaps the greatest gift to our society is a citizenry educated widely and with minds and hearts geared toward empathy toward their fellow man. I, for one, know at least a few highly trained computer engineers who seem basically indifferent to other human beings." Well, Michael, if you were doing a plebiscite here, these are public
radio.
It's
great to be back in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Well, how has your book been received in other places?
Well, I just did a NPR show in Dallas, Texas, and it was well received, and we had a great conversation about education. I have to keep emphasizing that I'm talking about pragmatic liberal education. I do think it's incumbent upon schools to give students the tools to do things out in the world and not just to refer back to their college years. One of my predecessors at Wesleyan, Victor Butterfield, said, if these are the best 4 years of your life, we failed you. You know, it really has to come out beyond the university. And I think it is up to us to keep those loan levels low and give students the courage and capacity to follow what they want to do in the world and find jobs that allow them to continue to learn, continue a life of inquiry.
Hear, hear. Let's hear from Philip. Hi, Philip.
Yes, good morning. I studied at San Francisco State, Michael, and one of the professors there back in 1976-1977, Jagdish Jain, whom you know, I'm sure, taught us one with one thing. He said, learn how to read a book well. I teach English as a second language, and he said, learn to use a dictionary, learn to use your grammar books, because once you learn to use the books, you don't need me. Another professor at the University of San Francisco by the name of Dean, D-E-A-N, Rader, R-A-D-E-R, wrote an op-ed piece in the Chronicle recently pointing out that the skill set that English majors develop prepares them for the job market. And thirdly, Adam Grant has written a book called Give and Take. And one of the chapters in that book, he refers to an accounting professor who teaches in North Carolina and Duke University, who gives an infinite amount of time to the students to develop what he calls the grit. The grit is how to the students who may fail an exam, he says, you did okay, go ahead, keep working, you're gonna make it. So what I want to ask your guest is, what is the role of the professor who gives time?
We've got seconds left here, Philip, I'm sorry to say, because that may be a whole subject for a whole hour in itself. It's a major role, though, I think we could say.
Absolutely, professors are absolutely key to giving these translational skills.
Michael Roth, his new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, formerly president of California College of the Arts, now president of Wesleyan University. Good to see you again. Thank you so
much
for
being
here,
Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zolt. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.